Okay, once again, a very good afternoon. Welcome to this talk organized by the Buddhist Fellowship. It is very nice to see every one of you here, despite the hot weather, and we also arranged for a blessing of showers, so the rain fortunately stopped in good time. Anyway, we are very, very happy to have Ajahn Brown with us. In fact, many of you may not know that he came straight from the airport. He has just arrived, actually. And being the compassionate monk that he is, he's going to be with us for a few hours and is back to the airport again to catch a flight.
So this is Buddhist Lodge is my new transit lounge.
Alright, I think Ajahn Brown needs no introduction. Just a little bit of ground rules. At the end of the talk, as usual, we'll be taking questions. We do ask that the questions be in written form, so that, again, out of compassion for Ajahn, he has to catch a flight, so we don't want to really keep him too long down here. So please, papers will be distributed, so if you have any questions, do write it down so that we can then collect and pass it on to Ajahn Brown. Alright, so without further ado, we invite Ajahn Brown to give us a talk. Thank you.
So the title of this talk, and I only found this out when somebody picked me up at the airport about 45 minutes an hour ago, is about the stages of enlightenment. So I'm not going to give a technical talk, because that's, you can read technical details in books. It's more like from the heart, and how like enlightenment affects our daily life, and how the closer you get to being enlightened, the happier, the more peaceful, the more free you feel. And so what I'm going to be talking about today is not something which is beyond your personal experience, but part of your experience, and hopefully by taking those parts of experience which you always find very peaceful, spiritual, blissful in your daily life, by taking them further, you can get some understanding of what enlightenment could be like, because that has always been the goal of Buddhism, to become enlightened. It's not so much to go to heaven, because you can go to heaven, but then you come back again afterwards. And so it's just like going to like a Club Med or going overseas for a holiday. You have to come back to go to work again. And so it's much more than that. It's going much deeper than going to a heaven realm. This is actually becoming enlightened. The very word enlightened, it conjures up a sense of like being wise, being peaceful, and getting to almost the heights of those spiritual qualities we call like compassion and wisdom. Those are the sorts of things which the word enlightenment conjures up. So I'm going to start with concepts like that and show just how we can take those concepts further to get a deeper understanding of what this enlightenment means and how it becomes not something which is beyond the possibility of you reaching. There's a wonderful thing. When I first became a Buddhist, I started reading all of these descriptions of what was happening in the time of the Buddha. It wasn't just the monks becoming enlightened and the nuns. It was ordinary people also getting enlightened experiences as well. And the people in the time of the Buddha, they were no different to the people in the, even in Singapore today. Same sort of people. And interestingly, even though this has got nothing to do with the subject, to show how people in those days and people today are the same, one of my favorite Buddhist stories is actually from the rules of the nuns' monastic order. It's called the Bhikkhuni Vinaya. And this is one of my favorite stories, which I usually only tell on retreats. But it shows you just how people just haven't changed in over 2,500 years. What was happening? Early one morning, in the nuns' monastery, one of the nuns had the task of cleaning out the toilets. Now in those days, there weren't sewage systems. It was just like a bucket. And you could imagine what sort of stuff was in that bucket. And even though it came from holy nuns, still it stank. So, this nun, one nun, she couldn't find a place to deposit, the produce of the toilet. So she thought, well, it's early in the morning, no one would notice. So she threw it over the monastery wall. Now it just happened to be her bad luck that on the opposite side of the wall was a businessman going off to see the king. Now when you go off to see the king, or here in Singapore, the president, or the PM, or the MM, you usually wear your very best clothes. And so this man had his best clothes on, his hair, well done, and he got a bucket of shit on him. So imagine that was you. What would your reaction be? He certainly wasn't pleased. In fact, he was very upset. And he knew where it came from. And he was so angry. He said, those aren't real nuns. They're just wastrels. They're sloppy. They're not real religious. What would they have done to me? And he was so upset. He decided to burn their monastery down. So he got sort of one of these firebrands, one of these old torches, and lit it, and went into the nuns' monastery with the intention of burning it down because of what they've done to him. But fortunately, they had this gatekeeper who was very smart. And when this man was going in to sort of burn down, I said, what are you doing that for? He said, look what they did to me. One of these nuns threw the contents of the toilet right over my head. And this man, the gatekeeper, said, really? That's auspicious. That's really lucky. It's not every day that that happens to somebody. And this man says, is it really lucky? Is that true? He said, yes, very, very lucky. Oh, this must be a great day for you. And obviously this gatekeeper was very good at talking to people, and this business person was very gullible, and he managed to convince him that it was good luck. So he said, go back home, get changed again. I'm sure when you go and visit the king, something good will happen. And fortunately, he believed the gatekeeper, didn't burn down the monastery, went home, got changed, went to see the king, and actually the king gave him a big contract. And so it was lucky. So you see, if ever you walk outside of a monastery or a temple, that happens to you in Singapore. But when the Buddha heard about it, he called all the nuns together and said, you were very lucky that time, but don't do it again. And that became one of the 300 and so rules for the nuns vinaya, not to throw buckets of shit over the monastery wall. But you can see just how people were lazy in those days, they're lazy in these days, how people get angry and want to destroy things, and it's only a small thing, and also just how superstitious people can be, and how wise people can be. So people haven't changed at all in 2500 years. Exactly the same. Any country, any race, any religion, any gender, human beings, the same character. And they always will have that character. And it's nice that they have that character. So, things haven't changed. But in those days, many people became enlightened. And these days, it seems to be so rare that people become enlightened. And why? So let's see what this enlightenment is, first of all. And how you can become at least a bit further on the stages to enlightenment. Now one of the very deep teachings about how to become enlightened is a very simple one. But it actually gets you very, very clear. And this is, I told a story last night because somebody asked me to give another talk on loving kindness. And this is that story which some of you have heard many times because it's a title story of the book which many of you have asked me to sign today. You probably already got it if you haven't bought it today. Open the Door of Your Heart. It starts off with a simple story But I'm going to take it deeper and deeper and deeper this afternoon. And that was the story when I was about 13 or 14 years of age, when my father was driving me back home from school, because he was working close by. So I walked from school to where he worked, wait for him to finish, and he'd drive me back to our, what was called a council flat. Now a council flat was an apartment owned by the government, which was given at a subsidized rate to poor people, because my father was very poor. And mostly because he was quite sick for most of his life. So he had a beaten up old car. He was taking me back from school, and to my surprise, he turned down a side street and parked. And he turned around to me because he wanted to say something to his son. And it turned out to be one of the most beautiful things I'd ever heard. What he told me in that car, just a father to his son, was this. He said, "Son, whatever you turn out as in life, wherever you go, whatever you do, I always want you to remember this one thing. That the door of my house will always be open to you. No matter what you do, my house is your house. The door will always be open to you." At that time, remember, I was only a teenager. So teenagers, they can't always understand what these things really mean. Except I recognized it was important. It was only later on in life, especially as a monk, you started thinking, what did he mean by that? Why was it important? He was sure it wasn't anything to do with his council flat, because it was a very, very sparsely furnished unit. In fact, as I joke, we were never, ever afraid of burglars when you're poor. In fact, very often we would actually leave the door open, hoping a burglar might come in, take pity on us, and leave something. So we were quite poor. So it wasn't his house he was talking about. It was only later on I realized that what he meant was, "Son, wherever you go, whatever you do, always remember the door of my heart will always be open to you. You're my son. I love you. And that love is unconditional. It doesn't matter how you turn out, what career you take, what path in life you follow. You're my son, and my heart will always be open to you." And that was something which was very precious to me. Not just because it was a father's very deep and profound love to his son, but also because it showed me how to love other people. And it also showed me an important part about enlightenment. Because, isn't it the case that enlightened people, they don't have hatred towards other people, not even anger towards them? That's one of the signs of being enlightened. But you just don't get angry. Why get angry? It's just human beings being human beings. Have you ever got angry when a dog barks at night and spoils your sleep? How stupid that is. What do you think a dog does? That's what a dog is like. It barks. It can bark at any time. Do you get upset when your wife nags at you? "Man, man, man, you've got to do this, you've got to do that." What do you expect? That's what wives do. The same as husbands. You know that part of being a monk, that people, you know, they tell you their problems. And I've heard so many marriage problems, though, so much marriage counseling. But one piece of advice I give, especially to you wives, when you complain about your husbands. One of the insights I've got from all these years of being a monk, that all husbands, they're all the same. So don't think there's something wrong with your model. You've got the standard edition, and they're all like that. So if you want to swap the one you've got to get another model, it's exactly the same engine inside. So one of the things is, that you don't get angry because you've got an understanding and a wisdom that this is just how life is. And just getting angry at it just makes you hurt even more. So we have this wonderful sense of compassion and kindness and love towards other people. Remember the unconditional part of it. To be able to say to your husband, to your wife, the door of my heart is always open to you, no matter what you ever say or do. Can you do that? No. But as you do that, more and more become more tolerant and more forgiving and more open, you're getting closer towards enlightenment. Because if he misbehaves, it's his karma, not yours. So if you get angry at him, then his bad actions, you're taking some of the pain of that as well. The same with her. So really, our job is not to take on the pain of other people. Not allow other people to control our own happiness. But for other people, to give them a sense of being cared for. An example, just last night I was asked why it is that many of you see in the news, in my country, Australia, there's been many bushfires and many people have lost their lives. Whole towns and communities have literally been wiped off the face of the earth by these incredible fires. And some of those fires have been lit on purpose. And you'll find that those people, if they are caught, are people who live alone, who have no friends, usually rejected by their family. There's something which I've always noticed, whether it's in serial killers, rapists, in this case arsonists, there's something which they haven't learned and experienced in life, that type of compassion. Where someone has opened the door of their heart to them and shown them what love is. To be able to get that sort of love towards other human beings is something which raises a person's goodness, and they will never ever do those horrendous crimes which create so much pain and suffering and tears in other humans or animals either. Love is something which we are not born with, which we learn and grow with, is part of the learning curve towards enlightenment. And the more that we can have this beautiful compassion, open the door of our heart towards others, the closer we are to being enlightened. Even that some people tried to murder the Buddha. And what happened when the murderers, the assassins came to see the Buddha? He was just too kind to murder. Sometimes you come across some people, even if you have some bad intent, just their kindness, their goodness, their peace is so powerful you just can't harm them. They're just too soft and cuddly to kill. And that was the case there. And what did the Buddha do? Did he hand him into the police? No, he just taught them a little bit of Dhamma and he forgave them straight away. There was no source of revenge. He showed them love and forgiveness and kindness. A person who's out to kill you and you show them kindness back. It's amazing what happens when you do that. People respond. And the reason why they act so cruelly, selfishly, tends to vanish. That type of compassion is a healing force. It's something which does take human beings to a higher level, which does stop crime. I was talking with Peter earlier, who goes off into the prisons to talk with some of the young offenders in the jails of Singapore. And I used to do that as well. And just showing a tiny bit of compassion and kindness to some prisoners changes their lives. I told this story last night. I don't know if this could happen in Singapore, but it's a great thing if it could happen. In one of the prisons I was teaching at, I arrived a little bit early, and one of the prisoners was waiting for me. He grabbed me by the arm and led me to one of the schoolrooms. And there on the notice board of the schoolroom were a number of cards written by children. And he told me where those cards had come from. A local primary school were concerned that their children might be exposed to drugs later on in their life. And they wanted to have some sort of program to protect these young people. Most young people will say no, but there's always a few who will get tempted. And once they're tempted, the results are horrendous for the family, for their friends, for their community, and obviously for themselves as well. So if you were a principal of a primary school, what can you do to try and ensure the best possible way of saving those kids from getting involved in drugs? This principal, she was so courageous and so wise, she invited two of the prisoners who were in jail for drug crimes to come and teach the children. Now imagine if you had a professor or some doctor or sociologist, they could tell the theory, but they can never speak from the heart of what happens to you when you actually take these drugs and get involved in this and end up in prison, what it's like and how it destroys your life. So two of these prisoners were invited into the classroom to teach the children what really happens when you follow that terrible, terrible path. And because they'd been there and suffered, they had authenticity. And I'm sure that those children would have been protected from a life or experimental with drugs more than any other children. But even more than that, these prisoners had an opportunity to contribute something positive towards society so that other kids would not go on that path that they went to. And of course, they were so delighted to be able to serve and to give. And when you serve and give a little bit, you get so much back in return, because the following day, in the art class, the teacher told those children to write some cards saying thank you to these two prisoners. Dear Nick, I hope you get out soon. Dear John, when you're released, please come and see us again. And this prisoner, as he was pointing out these cards, written with a type of care and unconditional love, which children can give to prisoners, but very few other people can, he started weeping, crying his eyes out, because children had shown him something he very rarely saw or felt in prison. This beautiful unconditional love of a child to a friend. Now that was something I thought was very beautiful. Win-win for both sides. That type of kindness and compassion is part of enlightenment. Even being able to have that type of compassion to a person who's dealt in drugs, dealt in death, as some people say, still kids could find compassion for those people. But there's something even deeper, because sometimes enlightenment is a personal journey. And as I've often mentioned, with that story of opening the door of your heart, there is the most important person you have to open the door of that heart to, is yourself. To one day, it's usually done in a very private moment, to think of yourself and all the things you've experienced, endured, achieved, all that you've done in life, and to really, with sincerity, to say to yourself, me, whatever I've ever done in life, whoever I am, the door of my heart is open to me. To give oneself this unconditional love and acceptance. Because before you do that, it's like there's two halves of you. The one which you like and accept, and another half which you feel very guilty about, which you don't like. You're separated. You're not at one with yourself. There's part of you which you haven't embraced. To be able to embrace that shadow side of you, that negative side of you, and to be at peace with your past and your present and future is part of what we mean as being enlightened. Yes, sometimes you are stupid, you do make mistakes. Sometimes that we're not perfect human beings, but we can still love ourselves nevertheless. So that's one of the first things about enlightenment. Learning how to be at peace with yourself. In a sense to say, whoever I am, whatever I've done in life, the door of my heart is open. Come in. Make peace. It's like sometimes you see some of the wars which happen in our planet. Say, you know, with Hamas and the Israeli government. And somewhere will that ever end? There's only one place such conflicts can end. And that has to be in some unconditional forgiveness. Where the parties say, whatever you've done over years, centuries, the door of our hearts are open to you. There is something very spiritual, very holy, very enlightening about such a type of love, because it stops the problems and creates peace in life. So that's the first thing about enlightenment. It's a path of even deeper and more profound and more extensive unconditional loving kindness. And that gives holy people immense power. You become invulnerable because people just don't want to harm you. Because they appreciate that degree of kindness so much. For those of you who have been members of this Buddhist fellowship for so many years, who have known me for all that time, I ask any one of you, especially old members, is there any ever occasion when I've criticized you, scolded you, and got angry at you, even though that many times you've deserved it? No, of course not. Just don't do that. And that way you actually get more out of people as a teacher. You actually encourage people rather than use force or use anger and scolding. And look how many people are here today. You find that degree of kindness and acceptance is very powerful and you feel it. And I don't just play this, this is real. When I say the door of my heart's open, I really mean it. If you can say that to yourself, how much at peace would you be? That's what we mean by enlightenment. Being at peace with things. The idea of peace, again, not just peace on the outside, because sometimes it's very hard to find peace in the world. Because there's always a little bit of conflict. People living close together will always be friction. There will always be arguments. There will always be differences of opinion. That's life. But when we know the rules of life, we know what life is, we have the insights and wisdom to understand what this world is, then we can make peace with it. We're making peace with the fact you know who your husband is, what wives are like, what teenagers are like, what bosses at work are like, what monks are like, what nuns are like. We understand what these things are and we can actually accept them and make peace with them. This is how this world actually is. More than that, sometimes our own body getting old and getting sick, having cancers, having HIV, having other diseases. Are you ever going to stop that? With all the advances of medicine, we can sort of extend amount of years we live. But sooner or later, some sickness gets us. We will never get rid of sickness in this world. So what hope is there for you? The hope is to learn to make peace with these sicknesses. A couple of days ago, a man, a member of our Buddhist society I've known for many years, he came up to me and he was very, very disturbed because he'd just been diagnosed with HIV. He wasn't a homosexual, not a drug user. Apparently he got it from a heterosexual person. And now he had HIV. And I told him, wow, you're so lucky. You've just become a member of a very elite, exclusive club. And I haven't got HIV, so even I can't join that club. And you'll make many, many friends, you know, because sometimes those things connect us together. And when I sort of showed acceptance, and even made a little bit of a joke about it, and put the positive spin on it, he was actually stunned by that. Because for days and days since the diagnosis, he had been depressed, ashamed. Nothing to be ashamed about, it's just sickness, what happens? And I showed him how to make peace with that. How to open the door of his heart to the fact he had HIV. Make something out of it. In the same way as many other people, you know, that you know who you are, I've known you for a long time, you get sick, you have your cancers, have depressions or whatever else has. It's amazing just how you can make peace with anything in life, how you can open your door to cancers, the door of your heart to cancers, and allow it to be. What's happening here is you learn how to make peace with life. You can't change life, but you certainly can change your relationship to life, the way you react to it, how you regard it, what you do when these things happen. Of course, there's many young people here. How many of you have been dumped? If you haven't yet, you will be. That's life. And their relationships, they come and they go. Maybe you might make a nice one sooner or later. But even that sometimes a lot of pain. So when this happens, if you get dumped as a young girl, young boy, don't worry about it. Just make peace with it. There's a lot of advantages when you're dumped. You know, it's much cheaper living alone than with a girlfriend or a boyfriend. But the idea with enlightenment is understanding what life is, doing the very best you can with life, putting in the effort to try and keep the relationships going, keep your health good. But when it doesn't work, well, I've done my best. No more could I have done. Now I can rest with this and be peaceful with it. What we're doing here is learning how to create this beautiful relationship with life, of love and peace, when there's nothing we can do. It's not you become lazy. Now these are things which I teach, but anyone who's known me knows how hard I work. It's not just getting on an aircraft and coming to Singapore and then getting off the plane and coming straight here and signing books, giving a talk, and I'll be all the way back to the airport answering questions, whoever drives me in the car, that's usually what happens. But I was up at, was it 4:30 this morning, had some work to do on the computer, just writing some letters. So I work really hard, 7 days a week, 52. And you, each one of you, one day you will retire. Me? No way. The older you are as a monk, the harder they make you work. Old monks become very famous. So I know what my future is. Work, work. So I work really hard. But it means making peace and being kind doesn't mean being lazy. It means you make peace with whatever you have to do. If you're a CEO, if you're a wife, if you're a professor, if you just drive a taxi, whatever you do in life, you do it to your very, very best and then you make peace with it. You allow it to be, you allow life to be, with all the work and the effort which you put into it. What you're doing here, understanding life, not asking any more than it can give. Understanding through insight, the enlightenment through understanding life, gives you an enormous amount of peace. Once you know there's nothing wrong with you, there's nothing wrong with the person you live with, there's nothing wrong with the boss or with the government. All governments are like that. All bosses are like that. All bodies are like that. We just get old and sick, that's it, and eventually we die. That's what life is. So when we understand it, accept it, make peace with it, and love it, then we are free. And this is the wonderful thing about enlightenment, the freedom which people can feel. A lot of times, people are very weird. They look at me as a monk and they think, wow, Ajahn Brahm, you know, you could be doing so many things in life. You've got all these rules, all the things which you can't do. You can't watch movies, you can't sort of go and watch the soccer, you can't have sex, you can't sort of have a glass of beer or a glass of wine, can't eat in the evening. There's so many things. You know what they call, you know, the female monks, nuns? None of this, none of that, none of anything else. They're called nuns. So you think, wow, what are you a monk like? It must be so hard and so painful and difficult. All these things you just can't do. And actually, no, it's not the case. From the inside, and I'm being honest here, once you become a monk, you feel so free, so peaceful, when you can't do all these things. Those of you who are as old as me, or even older, remember what it was like 30 years ago, or 35 years ago, going to a shop, say to buy some honey, or to buy some noodles or whatever. There's only one or two brands. So you go in the shop, buy it, and go out again. Now, there's 100 different brands. And it's just a pain in the head to try and choose what you're going to get. You see, so much freedom of choice gives so much suffering. Now there's something fascinating there. When you've got no choice at all, life becomes very simple. So, you know, we don't get any choice. What people put in your bowl, that's what you eat. You don't go shopping. Ah, it's just a relief not to have to go shopping. I see all these people, and it's not as if, you know, people like sort of spending money. But, you know, you have all these things, then you've got to find a place to put them when you get home. You've got to clean them and maintain them. If they're expensive, you've got to insure them. Oh, it's a pain in the butt, sort of, having all this stuff. And you've got to carry, see people coming home from shopping. All these bags. Oh, that must really make their arms ache. So all you guys shopping, it's masochism, I think. Torturing yourself. No. But what we really mean here is that sometimes as a monk, because you can't do these things, you feel very free. And this is what comes from one of the classic stories about enlightenment, about what real freedom is. In Singapore, are you free? Do you live in a free society? Or do you feel sometimes you're pressured? Even in the United States, is that the highest of the free societies? It's not. People who are in that society sometimes feel so much suffering. This is the reason why. This is a classic story, probably the best story to understand what enlightenment really is. It's a story of the five children playing the wishing game. It's in one of my books. Classic story. And it takes a very simple concept, which you can all understand, and it takes it to the very highest of concepts, enlightenment itself, in a way that you can easily understand. Five children were playing a wishing game. And a wishing game goes like this. Every child had a wish, and the child who managed to come up with the best wish would win the wishing game. So child number one didn't have much time to think, who was first. He really liked hamburgers. And his mother would never let him have one, usually. But he said, okay, if I had a wish, I'd wish for a McDonald's hamburger. A big, thick one, double, with double everything. Okay, very good. Now the next child, a girl. Now remember, she had a bit more time to think, and she heard what the first child thought. So she said, I can be that easily. If I had a wish, I would wish for a McDonald's restaurant. And then I can have a hamburger, not just one, but you know, many, many times, however long I want. And obviously that was superior. So they asked the third child, a boy, and he was very smart. Again, he had more time to think. And he came up with a wish. He was actually certain it would win. He said, if I had a wish, I would wish for $1 billion. Because with $1 billion, first of all, I'd buy my own McDonald's restaurant. That would be the first thing I'd buy. For the second thing I'd buy, I always like to play video games. So I'd buy my own video game store. That would be number two. Now the trouble is, when I try and play video games, my parents keep telling me that I should be doing my homework instead. So the third thing I'll buy is my own school. If I buy my own school, then I, you know, I need to go and turn up every now and again, because I own the school, I can always give myself good grades. And when I sort of graduate from my own school, I'll sell the school and buy my own university. So lots of private universities. Now I give myself a degree, and I can spend all time eating hamburgers and playing video games. And with $1 billion, that's more than enough money to last you your whole life. It'd be very difficult to spend $1 billion. So that child was clearly winning the wishing game. Now if anyone said $2 billion or $3 billion, that's not really a superior wish. That's on the same level, because $1 billion, $2 billion is as much money as you could ever use. So there's two children left. How could they beat the $1 billion wish? The fourth child is a genius. She said, I can beat that. If I had a wish, I would wish for three wishes. That's a wish. For my first wish, I'll have a McDonald's restaurant. For the second wish, I'll have $1 billion US. And for my third wish, I will have three more wishes. That way, I can go on forever. Beat that. Now that was a very smart kid, with the infinity of wishes granted. Could that be exceeded? It was exceeded. The last child would win the wishing game. He managed to think of a wish which was clearly superior than the infinity of wishes granted. That child said, if I had a wish, I wish I was so content I would never need any more wishes ever again. So content I don't need any more wishes. That's called the Buddha. Enlightened. So content you don't need any more wishes. Things come, fine. They don't come, fine. No more wishes. Contentment at last. Now that's peace. Now you see those last two, the infinity of wishes, we call that the freedom of desire. So whatever desire you have, you can get it. If you're powerful and wealthy enough, if you're a boy, any girl you like, any place you want to go, any food you want, any movie you want to see, you can just get it. That's called the freedom of desire. And much of our society has pursued enhancing the freedom of desire. So we can get on the internet and watch a movie, whatever movie we want to see, immediately in our bedroom. We can actually travel to any part of the earth we want to go. We can do so many things. We've been pursuing the freedom of desire for so many centuries. But has that really given us true happiness or a true sense of freedom? And our last boy was pursuing not the freedom of desire, but the freedom from desire. Seeing that actually the desire, if left unchecked, was not a friend, but was one of the great enemies. If you have too many desires, and they reign unchecked, they make your life a misery. If you have too many sexual desires, you can never be at peace with your wife or peace with your husband. The other young girl or young man is always more attractive, and you will follow that and break your marriage vows. If you desire food too much, you get sick. If you desire clothes too much, you get very poor. How many dresses do you need? You can only wear one at a time. How many pairs of shoes can you wear? So sometimes the freedom from desire, that's what enlightenment is. Being so content, you're just happy. People give you a robe to wear, fine. It doesn't matter what type of robe. I don't go shopping in Gucci or Versace. This is just an ordinary robe. It's not got a designer label on. And that way, you can have a great sense of being free from desires. Pass a shop, you don't need to buy. See the most beautiful girl in the world. I remember teaching in this small meditation group in Sydney once. And there was this very beautiful girl at the back there. It was only a small group, about 30, 40 people. She was looking at me and smiling. And looking at me and smiling. Hi. And I wonder what she was up to. And only afterwards, you know, when the class was over, I asked the organizer, I said, is this girl, she was making eye contact and smiling at me and stuff. But what's going on? I said, don't know her. She was actually a famous TV star in Australia. And she was really concerned that I didn't recognize her. Because I don't watch TV. And I think for any TV star, that really sort of throws you. And then any Australian, I think there was a girl, people said it was Lisa McLune or something. She's a famous sort of Australian TV star, goes on many sort of series. But you know, to me, she was just a girl sitting in the back. And I found her over, she was really upset at me. He didn't recognize me. And that's what it is. So I mean, for Mark, you're just a girl, just a boy, don't care, you know, who you are. Now what that really means is you've got no desire for people, desire for things. And what that means is you've got a tremendous amount of freedom. Sometimes I wonder why it is that people like to have counselling from a monk. When it's not just because we're free and cheap. Or maybe it is, I don't know. But it's also because, like a monk, especially because many of your problems are like romance, sex, you know, partnership problems, like a monk, it's not on either side. You know, we may have a man's body, but we dress like a girl. So we're almost like the umpire. We don't play on either side. But in particular, you know, you're not a sexual object. You're not someone you're going to sort of marry or have sex with. So you're not like a sexual object then. So when women come and talk to you, sometimes it means that they know that there's nothing sort of, they don't have to be guarded, but this is a future partner they're talking to. They can actually open up and talk like a friend who's not another competitor, like another girl, not a sort of a prize which they may get later on. It's someone different. And that puts monks and nuns on a different level. Because we're not objects of desire, and you're not an object of desire for the monk or nun, it's a completely different sort of a relationship. A relationship of openness and trust and freedom. It's amazing to actually see that. When you haven't got desires, we don't want anything from you. It's amazing how free that feels. How often is it when you talk to someone, you know, you get the feeling, what do they want? What do they want from me? From a monk, you want nothing. That's usually what I get also, nothing. That's what I want anyway. So this gives about the freedom from desire. This beautiful sense of peace. This beautiful sense of like love and compassion, not just for people, but for things as well, for the world. And for even tragedies which come up. It's every time there's a big tragedy, you can always see a silver lining to every cloud, and there is. You know, the bushfires in Victoria, the tsunamis, the earthquakes. There's a lot of tragedy there. There's enormous amounts of community pulling together, people caring for each other, the humanity of people concerning, say, the Sichuan earthquake, people on other sides of the world, caring and helping and growing. And when it's a tragedy, people learning about what's really important in life. Victorian bushfires in Australia. People say, look, the houses we can rebuild, they're not important. Even though we've lost everything, all our possessions, what's important? That our wife and children survived. That's what's really important. Tragedies highlight what's really important in life. And sometimes we need those tragedies to remind us. And that's why they always have a silver lining. It's always something you learn from something. That's why you can love life. Even the painful part of life. Because that is our teacher. For those of you who haven't heard this particular story, young monk, me being a young monk in Thailand with these voracious mosquitoes. I'm going back to Thailand tonight, so I'm going to see some of the ancestors who've got some of my DNA. Because many have sucked my blood for years. So I'm going to see the ancestors of those mosquitoes, or rather the progeny of them, rather. But anyway, it got so bad once. There was no mosquito coils, no mosquito repellent, no mosquito nets, nothing. It was just, you know, like a free sort of dinner for all those mosquitoes. And it got so bad that we would complain to our teacher, Ajahn Chah. For those of you who don't know, Ajahn means teacher. It's a title. So Ajahn Chah was mean that teacher Chah, Ajahn Brahm, teacher Brahm. So, we went to complain to Ajahn Chah, please can you get us some mosquito repellent? We're Westerners, we're not used to this. Can you get some nets or something? And he said, no. I said, what are we going to do then? He said, from now on, those mosquitoes, you will call them Ajahn Mosquito. They are now your teachers. And I was turning the problem, you know, upside down. And it was a brilliant answer. Because you did learn so much from those rotten, you know what. It's the same way with any other tragedy. It's been Ajahn bushfires. It's been Ajahn cancer. It's Ajahn dumped. If you've just lost a boyfriend or girlfriend. It's Ajahn recession. It's true, you can learn so much about life from these things. So it's the learning is the meaning of life. And the more that we learn from difficulties, tragedies, and also from happiness as well, you learn from everything in life. The more you learn about what love is, what real compassion, and its importance in the path to enlightenment. How it is an expression of enlightenment. The power of peace. When you understand nature, life, you realize it's a waste of time fighting it. You're fighting a battle against nature, a battle you can never win. So you make peace with it. Then you find the battle has been won when you make peace. And then you also learn about this wonderful idea of a freedom from desire, of being content. At the very least, find moments in your life, days, hopefully weekends, when you can sit in your apartment, your house if you've got one, or garden,
and just be content. Enjoy what you have,
rather wondering what more you can get.
At least spend time resting that way,
appreciating your family which you have around you, your wife, your husband, your kids, your parents,
appreciating them.
Not thinking of what more you're going to get tomorrow, but what you've got today. One person once said, it is wanting more stops us enjoying what we have. Wanting more stops us enjoying what we already have. We have to have a bit of wanting more to allow our life to progress. We should have times, spaces, where we stop wanting more and enjoy what we have. Enjoy our family, enjoy our little apartment, you know, enjoy our health. Even if you are old already, enjoy it while you're there, because you may not be as young as you used to be, but you're certainly not as old as you're going to be. So enjoy it while you've got it now. And that way, you can have this beautiful sense of how to really live in life and get the most out of it and understand what enlightenment truly is. And of course, once a person has learned all these lessons, they understand what love is, what freedom is, what contentment is. Of course, you don't have to come back to school again. You graduate, which means bye-bye world, I'm leaving now. So that's actually what we mean by an enlightened being like a Buddha, who leaves samsara, having learned all that there is to learn, and having passed on those teachings to countless other beings, so they too can teach others. And so the whole wheel of Dhamma rolls again and again and again. It's the teachings, the Dhamma, these truths, that's what's important. The people are not important. Not the Buddha, not the sort of the great saints, the great masters, the great nuns. That's not really important. What's important is the teachings which they give, which continue on and grow and grow and grow and spread throughout the whole world. And each one of you one day will understand these teachings. You already understand a lot of them. They just grow on you as you finally create more peace, more happiness, more sense of freedom in life. All the problems in life which cause you so much pain and suffering, the problems of finances, problems of marriage, of children, of health, you find you don't need to worry about them so much. Even your own personal problems, you've maybe made mistakes, you don't have to feel so guilty, you can actually love yourself and be at peace with yourself. Imagine taking that further. You get closer and closer to enlightenment. And when you fully learn the lesson, then you graduate. And you can throw your hat up into the air as you've graduated from this university called samsara. Now, of course, you know I've been teaching this for a long time now. But I often say that I'm not a good teacher. And this sign, the proof that I'm not a very good teacher, is the fact I've been teaching some of you for I don't know how many years, and you're still coming back to class. So if that happened at the school, imagine you were a high school teacher, and so the grade 10s were coming back year after year after year after year after. I get the sack. But enlightenment is a bit different. It takes a long time to get these teachings in. And you know it's going in the right direction. How you can know it's enlightenment, well, you're getting closer and closer, because it makes you more peaceful, more happy, and more kind. More peaceful, more happy, more kind. If that is where you're going, you're on the path to enlightenment. And if you're not sure whether you're getting more peaceful, more happy, kind, ask your wife. Ask your husband. Ask your friends. Because they will find out. They will know. And if you are, then you realize that you're actually on the path to enlightenment. And these are the stages of enlightenment. The stage of increased happiness, increased peace, the increased ability to be compassionate to things which sometimes people think, how on earth can you be compassionate to arsonists?
How on earth can you be compassionate to terrorists? How can you be compassionate to cancer? You find it can be done. The closer you get to enlightenment, you find why it's done and how beautiful it is. Peace at last. So those are the stages of enlightenment. Hope it made sense. Okay, that's it.
All right, in typical Buddhist style, can we say sadhu, sadhu three times to Ajahn Brahm? Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. All right, it's question times, and if you have penned down your questions, you can just pass to the green-shirted PROs among us, or yellow-shirted. And please keep your question short and crisp and concise.
And it can be on any subject, it doesn't have to be on enlightenment. But first, there's a question someone gave me beforehand, and it's, all compounded things are subject to decay, as taught by the Lord Buddha. In other words, all things pass. To the disciples, the Lord Buddha told his disciples, especially Ananda, that he could remain longer. He said, complete the whole full lifespan. He said, could remain on the earth, this earth for a long time if they requested him to do so. And this raises a question. Since all things are subject to decay and humans can live normally less than 100 years, in what form can a Buddha remain on this earth? Now, what the question is there, the Buddha actually said he could live much longer than the 80 years. But he can't live forever, not in a human body. He was saying basically that the length of life, the longest length of life which was recorded in those days was 120 years. So he could say he could go on for another 40 years. But there wasn't any point to that because his purpose had been fulfilled. What he'd achieved was to get enough teachings going. He realized that that Dhamma, the teachings of Buddhism, had enough momentum, they would not be stoppable. They would carry on. Of course, we know that Dhamma is here in Singapore, 2,500 years after the Buddha passed away, and a little bit more. So again, see what the Buddha did. He got the wheel going, and it's keeping on going even now. But there's a nice saying of the Buddha, saying that the one who sees the Buddha sees the Dhamma. The one who sees the Dhamma sees the Buddha. And the Dhamma is like the truth, the teachings. By that saying, he was saying that the Buddha and the Dhamma, almost exactly the same. So it's not the person, but what they teach, what they represent. That's the important thing. So it's the Buddha passed away, but the Dhamma, the most important thing, that's still going. That's still alive, as powerful as ever. And that's the most important thing. People come and go, but the truth, and expounding that truth, sharing that truth, that is something which doesn't die. And that's the most important. Hopefully that answers that question. Does a lack of desire translate to lack of passion for life and compassion for living? No, it's compassion. So there's different types of passion. Dispassion, compassion, and the usual type of passion. But the lack of desire is, it's not so much the lack of desire, but contentment. There's a slight difference here. Because being content means being content to do your duties, being content to work hard, being content, you know, to volunteer for the Buddhist fellowship as helpers and serving and working and looking after things. So contentment is doing your duties in life. Contentment is not being lazy. So sometimes people make the mistake that they think that contentment is just being lazy. Sitting here and I'm so content. Why should I get up out of bed in the morning? I'll just sit here. That's crazy. So Contentment means you're happy with your lot in life, happy with the duties and responsibilities you have to yourself, to your family, to your country, to your world. You are content with that. You're content with the body you have, you look after it, you care for it as best you can, but you're content within those limits. So contentment doesn't mean no desire at all. I often wondered, if you were enlightened and had no desires at all, imagine not even any desire, not the slightest desire, suppose you needed to go to the toilet and think, no desire, go here, go in the toilet, who cares? That's crazy stuff. So even the Buddha went to the loo. So contentment doesn't mean no desire. I've got heaps of questions now. Very good. Here we go. You mentioned that the Buddha teachers are not important. I thought, although only through our teachers are we able to receive the teachings. Please elaborate. Yeah, okay, the teachers, they are the vehicles. And even if you get a Ferrari, it's the driver which makes the car go fast or crashes that car. So the Buddha is like the vehicle. The teachers are the vehicle. It's what they contain. The Dhamma is most important. And that's that old story of the difference between the containers and the contents. And if you don't know that story, I told this one yesterday as well, but to another crowd. Guantanamo Bay. Several years ago, there was an accusation, it was unproved but quite likely to have happened, that a US Marine took a copy of the Holy Quran, put it in a toilet bowl, and pulled the chain and flushed it down the toilet. And Muslims throughout the world were in outrage, protesting down the streets. It was a worldwide phenomenon of desecration of their holy book. Even in Australia, that was front page news. So being a Buddhist leader of the Buddhist community in Australia, I got a call from the local paper. Someone was doing an article and they were asking every religious leader the same question. What would you do, Ajahn Brahm, if somebody flushed a Buddhist holy book down the toilet? What would your reaction be? Without missing a beat, I said, sir, if somebody flushed a Buddhist holy book down the toilet, first thing I'd do is call a plumber. It's obvious. You know, you've got to use that toilet. I don't know why other people didn't think of that. And if the Muslims had thought about that, half of America would have converted to Islam. But, I made that joke, and I made the most important part of my response. I said, look, as a Buddhist, you can flush as many holy books down the toilet as you want. You can destroy Buddhas. You can burn down temples and even kill monks and nuns. But I will never allow you to destroy Buddhism. I'll never allow you to put compassion and flush it down the toilet. To blow up forgiveness. To burn down peace. To throw away wisdom. Because this is what is the contents of the religion. The Buddhas are the containers. The teachers are the containers. The temples are the containers. The books are the containers. It's what's inside of the message in those words. The meaning of a Buddha statue behind me, what's that supposed to be conveying to you? What's its contents? It's supposed to be meaning peace and compassion and kindness and freedom. It's the contents. If people sort of, you know, blow up that Buddha statue and it makes you angry, you've missed the point. They can blow up the statue, but don't let them blow up peace. Don't let them destroy compassion. And then you know they're not destroying what real Buddhism is. The containers and the contents. Well, we make that difference. Containers, they can come and go. Just like the Buddhas come and go. Teachers come and go. They're just the containers. They're just the vehicles. No, monks and nuns who transmit the Dhamma, but it's the Dhamma, the contents are the most important. If you understand that, you understand why, well, we build beautiful temples, but if we lose them, that's fine. And even if we build them, it's how we build them that's really important. Not just the structure, but where did it come from? How was it built? And how much kindness, compassion came into the building of this place? How it's built is more important than what is built. Are there actually blood on these walls? Is there lots of tears in the woodwork? Or is this inspiration and compassion and kindness and generosity? So how things are done is more important than what's achieved. The process is more important than anything else. Anyway, how can we be at peace with ourselves? As sometimes when I try to accept myself, I feel even more horrible. You're not horrible. I've yet to see a horrible person. Look, I've worked in prisons, seen people who've done rapes, who've murdered. You know, real fraudsters who've caused huge amount of suffering for people. I've never seen a horrible person. You know, gone into a jail and seen these notorious criminals, one of the things which everybody says when they come out afterwards, they're just the same as you and I. They're not like from another planet, like Martians. They're just like you and I. Why are they like you and I? Because they're not a murderer or a rapist or an arsonist. They are people who've done a murder. People who've done a rape. A person who's lit a fire. They're a person first. And mostly. And those things which they're put in jail for, only a fraction of what they are. A tiny part of their life. And you cannot define a person because of one or two bad acts. Or 10 bad acts. Or 100 bad acts. What about the 100 million other acts they've done in their life? Same with you. If you feel horrible, you're just looking at what I call the two bad bricks in the wall and missing the 998 good bricks in the wall. If you want to know more about that story, first story and open the door of your heart. So when you look at yourself, you have to look at the whole of you. Not just the negative and the mistake side, but look at the beautiful part of you. All the wonderful things you've done in your life. All your kindness and goodness and beauty and care. And it's there. And as a monk, it's just what you trained yourself to do. To see someone and see their beauty. See their goodness and kindness. And if I do that to you, if I see it in you, then you see it in yourself. And you realize you're not a horrible person at all. You're a beautiful, kind, gentle, wonderful person. I'm not just saying that to suck up to you. I don't get anything out of this. I'm saying it because it's true. What a wonderful thing it is to like yourself. I don't mean you need to change yourself. But part of those things which you call a horrible, they're almost like your features. The things which make you individual, the thing which gives you character and texture, you're not perfect, neither am I. But you're good enough, more than good enough. I can love you, why can't you? Did you kill the mosquitoes in the end? If not, how do you handle someone that attempts to hurt or harm you? No, you couldn't. It's against the rules to kill the mosquitoes. You can't swat them. So what you did next, you couldn't swat them, so you tried to flick them. Without harming them. But you know what they did? You'd flick them, and they'd just do what in aerobatics is called a loop-de-loop. And they go around another part of your skin. So you get two bites, where you usually have one. So it's completely irrational trying to move them. You just let them bite you once, get their dinner, and then they go away. So they bite you, and you just go, come on, get it over and done with. And you know what but this is actually true. You experience this. When you're compassionate to something, sometimes they take advantage of you. If you experience that, that's what mosquitoes did. You say, okay, whatever you want, go and take your dinner and get out of here. But they took what we call exploratory drilling hole, first of all, down here. They didn't like it over there, so they walk a few steps and do another hole down there. No, that's not tasty enough. Walk another. And they do about 4 or 5 bites. They really took advantage. But no, it's only mosquitoes, only a tiny little irritation, that's all. And so actually you just allowed them and let them be. And actually you found out, it was only recently, a few years ago, reading a scientific article, you realize that mosquitoes, they're attracted by the carbon dioxide coming out of your pores. When your metabolism is high, more carbon dioxide comes out and you are like a neon sign to those mosquitoes. You know, Ajahn Brahm's lunch bar, all mosquitoes welcome. But when you don't worry, when you're at peace, when you just relax, metabolism goes down, less carbon dioxide comes out, you become more invisible to mosquitoes. So actually, the more compassion you have, and the more peace you have, the less mosquito bites you get. That's science. What is the first sutra to disappear from this world? Okay, it's not the first, not the last. The sutras are not so important. Because remember the sutras, they are just containers. As long as you've got a couple of sutras there, a couple of teachings of the Buddha, and people who've understood them, who can actually explain them, that's all you really need. Because sometimes, have you ever seen the whole of the Tripitaka? Or all these books, even here, you've got all the canon of Buddhist scriptures. There's a whole library of them. Hundreds of books. And if you become a Buddhist, you think, oh God, do I have to read all of those? You don't. Because what is the holy book of Buddhism? Sometimes you go in schools in Australia and they ask that question, what's the holy book of Buddhism? And I say, it's not the Tripitaka. It's not the Abhidharma, it's not the Agamas, it's not the Prajnaparamita Sutras, it's not the Lotus or Heart Sutras, that's not the holy book of Buddhism. The holy book of Buddhism is meditation. Looking inside yourself, it's in here where you find the Dhamma. Those books we call the signposts, otherwise known as the menus. And I'm sure you know this story about a very wealthy man in Singapore, and there was a new 6-star restaurant opened up, and he made a booking for this restaurant. Even though it just opened, he had to wait a couple of months to get a reservation. When it came to that day of his reservation, he obviously had to wear a very expensive suit. He turned up to the restaurant, the maitre d' had to check he had a reservation, he was properly attired. He was, so the maitre d' took him to his table. Such an expensive restaurant, the menu was actually printed on a card in gold embossed writing. It was a beautiful menu. So this man received the menu, said thank you to the maitre d', then he ate the menu, paid and left. That was a very stupid man. Now what that means is, sometimes people can read these sutras, can memorize them, can write PhD theses on them. They've just eaten the menu, that's all. They haven't ordered the food. So it's ordering the food. What are those teachings, those sutras pointing to? Now, it says sort of, whether it's dim sum or whether it's noodles or whatever, what's that pointing to? You order the food. So those sutras, they're menus. Menus by the great chef, the Buddha. And he's asking you to try some of this amazing, delicious food. You try it, and then you understand what the Dhamma is. So as long as that doesn't disappear, then Buddhism is still alive. Is Buddha actually a form or an energy? I prefer like to what I said, the Buddha is the Dhamma. That's the most important part of a Buddha. The truth, the teaching which he contained and epitomized. The compassion, the peace, the freedom, the stillness, the peace. Now that is, you can say it's an energy. But it's a very still and calming and liberating energy. And it doesn't live out there. It lives right inside of you right now. Just needs to be recognized, encouraged and grown like a seed which can grow into a great Bodhi tree in your heart. How to overcome harsh criticism from those jealous of you. Remember that you only have to live with them for a few minutes every day. For they have to live with themselves 24 hours every day. So it's easy, you can get away from them. They're jealous and they harsh criticism. Yeah, they can say that, whatever they want to say. In one ear, out the other. Don't allow other people to control your happiness. Why, when they say stupid things to you, why do you worry about that? If somebody calls you, say, ugly, why do you get upset? There's only one reason why you get upset if they call you ugly, and that is because you believe they may be right. If you know they're wrong, you don't get upset. So if they criticize you, the only reason you get upset is because you believe they may be right. If you know they're wrong, you don't deserve that criticism, then you won't get upset. You know better than them. So just let it all wash over you. If we are contented, how would the world be? Well, much better than it is now. It is the ambition of many people that drive revolution. Well, I don't know if it's revolving in the right... Something's got to revolve the right way around, not the anti-way around. How do you achieve this balance? But first of all, I think you can all agree that a little bit more contentment in our life would create much better happiness for our society. If we're only more content, you know, with our husband, with our wife, we're more content with our kids. They may not sort of, you know, go to Harvard or Yale or Oxford or Cambridge. They may not get the top scores at school. And if they do, if you are a member of, or you come to a temple like this, if your children come in the top 5% or the bottom 5% at school, you are not a good Buddhist. You're not a good Buddhist. Because doesn't Buddhism believe in the middle way? So, tell your kids to come in the middle somewhere. Be a good Buddhist. They encourage your children to do the best. No, but only half of children will be above average. It's a very wise saying. Now, only half of people are above average. Obvious. So be kind to your kids. Okay, but too much ambition creates so much stress. So much pain, it's not worth it. So, when I say contentment, it's not lazy, just strive, but not over much. And at least give yourself like an hour of contentment every week. You know, maybe, how many hours is there in a week? 168. 1 hour of just contentment, sitting down and being so content with everything, not wanting anything, not doing anything, not striving to achieve or change things. 1 hour of contentment, that's all we ask a week. That's called meditation. That's why meditation lessens stress, heals illnesses, and makes you more happy with the people you live with and more happy with yourself. And once you understand what contentment is, you'll understand, actually, contentment doesn't mean you don't achieve things in life, but it means you achieve more. With a bigger smile on your face. My child has been bullied in school since primary 1. Now in primary 6 he's full of anger and wants to be a bully himself. What should I do? Please advise. You can go and send him to a monastery. He gets so much kindness, compassion that there we get the bully out of him. Because sometimes, remember, if you've been bullied yourself, you know, that sometimes that conditioning is just what gets into you. There's an old Buddhist story And there was, it's in the Jataka tales, there was an elephant, a royal elephant, which is usually a very placid elephant, but he changed his character within a few weeks and he got very irritable, would never sort of do what he was told, and became very, very sort of angry and a bad elephant. Like elephants were like, you know, the cars, like the Toyotas and the sort of the Fords of those days, those BMWs. And so this elephant was getting really out of hand. And no matter what the king tried to do, they could not change this elephant's behavior. They didn't know what he was up to. So they asked one of these wise ministers, who was a Buddha in his previous life, can you check it out? So he actually sat up all night with this elephant, just to observe, first of all, before you make conclusions, get your evidence. So as he was actually sitting up all night next to the elephant stall, he heard a strange noise behind the elephant stall. Very sort of quietly, he went to investigate, and he found there was a group of thieves were meeting every night behind the elephant stall because it was secluded. And they were planning their escapades that night, where they're going to rob, you know, who they were going to assault. And this wise minister realized how that elephant had changed its character. Even though it didn't understand human language, it was just picking up from the negative energy of those thieves every night for a long time. And so the wise minister just told the king, and the next night they arrested those thieves. But then the wise minister arranged for monks to go behind the elephant stall for the next month to talk about Dhamma or to meditate. And even though the elephant couldn't understand any word of English, he just got hold of the vibes of the monks. You know, the quietness and peace and compassion from the meditation. And the elephant went back to this very placid, good elephant afterwards. Because sometimes it's not just the words, it's the body language and who you're with. If you're with calm people and compassionate people, you become compassionate and kind. So that sort of child, as you know, being with a bully, you can see how he changes his character. If you can get him to be with nice people, good people, get him to... There's a youth group for the Buddhist Fellowship, isn't it? A kids group? You know, enroll him in the kids group here. So be with very kind, compassionate, peaceful people, and he'll change his character. That's the story of the elephant, how we are conditioned by the people we hang out with. But Ajahn, when one reaches Nibbana, how long does that moment last? Timeless, timeless. Because Nibbana, it's, whenever you get into any sort of meditation, I don't know how many people have experienced this, even you may not be experts, sometimes you meditate, you don't know how long has gone past, 10 minutes, an hour. There's this great story recently, there was a Vietnamese monk who went to Australia to teach a 9-day meditation retreat. So usually, have a half an hour meditation before the first talk. After half an hour, the monk was still meditating. 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock. So everyone, even the monk, hadn't come out of his meditation yet, so they went to bed. Got up the next morning, he was still sitting there, hadn't moved. For the whole 9 days, he never moved. That's what I call a monk. Even these days, people can do that. You know, not going to the toilet, not eating or drinking or anything, just perfectly still in deep meditation. It can be done, I know it can be done. Now that's when you get to timelessness. The more still you are, the more this whole idea of time has no meaning. If any philosophers are here, time is created by desire. It's a craving makes time. When desire finishes, so does time. Equanimity, a great state of mind lasting 3 to 7 days. What's the difference with Nibbana? Okay, you may call that a taste of Nibbana, when everything stops. But it's a taste, because it doesn't stop forever. When it really stops, and nothing moves, silence and peace. That's Nibbana. A lay person reaching 4th stage arahant would die within 7 days and take in monkhood. True or myth? Actually, that's true. Because it's like a round peg in a square peg in a round hole. You don't fit. So if you become enlightened, fully enlightened, and the whole hog, then eventually you think, well, why not become a monk? You've got no desire anymore, no sexual desire, no wanting all these clothes or jewelry or stuff. So it's just where you belong. So if a person becomes an arahat, they just go to the nearest monastery and join the monastery, become a monk or a nun. If for some reason they can't do this, they've graduated. So when you graduate, you either become a professor and you teach others, or you're out of here. You don't stay around in school once you pass your exams. I heard that monks at the monastery would have to leave after 5 years. They don't have to, but this is only the forest tradition, because the idea is that you get your basic training in one monastery, but it doesn't matter how good a teacher you are, you're always strong in some things and weak in other things. So if you go to another monastery, then you can actually get some teaching from other monks, other nuns, whatever. And you get a much wider sort of a teaching base. And the same, if you go to a university, you don't just have one teacher for, say, chemistry. You have 10 or 20. Or for business studies or economy or economics. So leaving the monastery where you train and going to different monasteries to practice is the way of widening your experience. That's why we encourage that. But it's not absolutely necessary. I didn't read the last part of this question. I heard that monks at monasteries would have to leave after 5 years. Do members of the Buddhist fellowship also have to leave after 5 years? Oh, what a brilliant question. No. Okay. We've got some more. Okay, I thought we finished. Okay, can we keep going on? It's 3:30. Keep going. Okay. If anybody wishes to leave, I'm the most hardest of monks to offend. So you can get up if you need to go to the toilet or if you need to sort of go back for another appointment. No need to sort of stay here thinking, oh, I can't go, I might offend the Venerable One. No, you are free to come and go wherever you want, whenever you want. So if you have to go now, it's 3:30, you can go. If you want to stay, you're most welcome to stay. Many philosophers, Thomas Aquinas, etc., have argued for the case of a God or higher being, and the arguments are really convincing. Really? What is the Buddhism take on the issue of a higher being? I think it was, not Thomas Aquinas, but who's the other fellow? St. Augustine. St. Augustine had this, he was a Christian, but he had this saying which was almost shown by his honesty that he was really having trouble with his beliefs. Because he said that if God is all-powerful, He cannot be compassionate because suffering exists. And if He's all-powerful, He doesn't do anything about it. Didn't do anything about the bushfires, Cyclone Nargis, Sichuan earthquake. If God is all-powerful, He can't be compassionate. If He's all-compassionate, He can't be all-powerful because suffering exists. Can't have it both ways, reasonable and logical. And the idea of a God creating this world. I've been a scientist from Cambridge University, still hang out with physicists. It was about a year and a half ago, we had a Roger Penrose came through Perth. And Roger Penrose, he's the guy who discovered black holes. He's Mr. Black Hole. An interesting fellow, actually, because he's a brilliant physicist from Oxford, but a complete sort of dag, as they say. You know, his suit was all crumpled, and even though he's brilliant in front of a blackboard giving a lecture, he just couldn't have a conversation with anyone. Even though he was like a star, he had all these other physicists and myself there, because I was honorary physicist for the evening, and he was just a wallflower. In the end, we started talking to each other, and this guy, this was supposed to be the guest of honor, was just standing up there just twiddling his thumbs. No one wanted to talk with him. I try to engage him, but this person just can't engage with. He's just inside of himself. But anyway, I hang out with all these physicists. The origin of this universe is quite clear, very well explained by modern science. You don't need a God to start this universe. Ask any scientist that. And anyway, what do you mean this universe? Modern science, Carl Epstein, it's called brain theory, not B-R-A-I-N, but B-R-A-N-E, shorthand for membranes, which is an adaptation of string theory, was predicting that not one universe, but many universes, serial universes, one after the other. If it can happen once, why can't it happen twice, three, four, many times? Exactly what the Buddha said. Now, and this is, I'm not interpreting. The Buddha said he remembered over 90 eons of existence. That's over 90 big bangs and endings of universes. So it's not just this universe, but many universes have existed. And why not? So that makes the whole idea of like a God pretty redundant as a creator of this universe. But then we've also got the role of a God as someone who can actually get involved and help you out in times of trouble. You know, in other words, someone who can interfere with the laws of nature to help you. And again, that becomes untenable. Mostly it was the Christians and the Muslims who died in the tsunami in Sri Lanka, because they were like the fishermen and their families. And the Buddhists actually lived in land, because in Sri Lanka, fishermen was not a sort of regarded as a proper profession for Buddhists. You'd think that if there was a God, they would save the people who worship the God. It doesn't work that way. That's why that many people who go to some of these Pentecostal churches, they go for 1 or 2 years and it doesn't work. They don't get cured. They don't sort of get anything out of it. So they leave in the end, because it doesn't work. So the God who interferes with life, that doesn't work either. There are many Christians who I respect a lot. And these are people whose idea of a God is not of a creator, not as like an uncle in the sky who can help you in times of need. Their idea of a God, and this is, you know, the modern idea of a God in most Christians in the West, is of a principle. Like the God is love, the God of truth, the God equals Dharma idea. Like a principle, not a person. Now if you get to a principle of truth, of compassion and kindness and freedom, if you call that God, then I'm on your side. But if you have like a God who just grants you favours, you know, because you give a big enough donation in the box, or you know, you do so many sort of chants or whatever, then that doesn't make any sense to me at all. And that is actually dangerous. Because when you go praying for God to help you, you should have actually been doing something for yourself. You know that old story of the floods in Malaysia a few years ago? There was a priest in his church. Just when the floods came, he was caught on top of his roof. A boat came to rescue him. And they said, "Get in, Father, Reverend, you know, we've come to save you. The flood waters are still rising." He said, "No, I will not get in. I have faith in the Lord. Jesus will save me. I don't need to get in." He said, "Look, the flood waters are rising. Get in the boat." He said, "No, it's the test of my faith. Go away." So they couldn't force him, so they left him on his roof. So, floodwaters rose, and he was on top of his steeple. When another boat came, he said, "Look, this is the last boat we've heard about you. Get in the boat, the floodwaters are still rising." He said, "No, even though I'm on top of my steeple, this is a test of my faith. God will save me. I don't need a boat." And again, they couldn't force him, so they had to go away. The floodwaters rose. So now he was holding on to the top of his TV aerial. When a helicopter came, and they dropped the rope down and said, "Reverend, look, there's no more left. Your TV aerial is the highest part of your church. Get in the boat, the flood water, get on the end of the ladder, we can haul you up, the flood waters are rising." He said, "No, this is a test of my faith. I've been worshipping Jesus all my life, God will save me." "Don't be a fool. I'm not a fool. You're fools." They couldn't force him, so they had to fly away. You know what happened? Floodwaters rose, he drowned. So imagine what he felt like when he went up to heaven and he met God. He was very angry at him. He said, "Look, you've made a fool of me. I've been worshipping you all my life. I told other people to believe in you when I needed you. You never helped me, and you embarrassed me. I had faith in you. You never did anything." And God smiled and said, "What do you mean I didn't do anything? Didn't I send you 2 boats and 1 helicopter? Now you can understand why some people's faith is a bit stupid. So if you are a Christian, God sent you a doctor. So if you've got an illness, go and see the doctor. Don't go praying in church. Okay. Anyway, that's enough about that. I'm graduating and I'm feeling rather insecure and lost about what type of job I should look for. Should I try to search for a goal in my career? I know sometimes when you graduate, you have to sort of look for many areas. Sometimes you don't know what your life is going to lead to. So when you graduate, keep a few options open. You're still young. Try a few things. Be adventurous. And that way sometimes you'll get a job, you'll get a career, and hopefully you'll find that this is who you are, this is what you've always wanted to do. It might not be a career, maybe just like a married person or something. That's what you really want to do. I'm a husband, I'm a father, that gives me fulfillment in life. Because for me, and after sort of graduating as a school teacher, now I became a monk, and as soon as I became a monk, that was it. After 3 or 4 days, literally, I knew this is what I always wanted to do in life. And I went around telling all my friends, I'm going to be a monk forever. I said, I've only been a monk for 3 days. You're going a bit over the top. I said, no, I know. And I was right. Because you know, sometimes you get into a role and that's who you are. And it's so wonderful to know you're in the right spot. So if you graduate, have a look around until you find that right spot for yourself. You've got time. You're still young, so don't rush. My mother is very depressed over my brother's sudden death. She has hinted that she may take her life. What can I do to help her? If you take your life, you don't get rid of depression. In fact, after you've taken your life, you're still there. Afterwards, your ghost. That's really depressing. So in other words, your depression, your emotional state, does not disappear if you take your own life. You suffer even more afterwards. When, having killed yourself, you're still there afterwards, and you see the pain and suffering you've caused those people who care about you. Imagine what that must feel like. Because those of you who have experienced, you know, a sudden death or suicide, it hurts. Especially with someone you love very much, it hurts deeply. So if you kill yourself, you're killing a huge part of the people who love you. It's not just all about you, it's about others as well. And depression does pass. I mean, especially if you've got a good attitude, you can learn from death, your brother's sudden death. If you can learn from it, you can grow from it, it becomes a wonderful experience in life. All those experiences in life which you have, the most unpleasant ones, can sometimes be the best. Just like that simile of the person who goes home today, and on the way home, they tread in the dog shit. If you tread in the dog shit, you should never wipe it off your shoes until you get home. So bring it home with you, and then wipe it off in the back garden where you may have a mango tree. And 1 year later, if you follow my advice, your mangoes will be sweeter than ever before. But when you taste that beautiful, sweet, delicious, juicy mango, you must always remember what you're truly eating. It's dog shit, but transformed into the most luscious mango. Now you understand, sometimes you know, these experiences in life are just so painful and so disgusting. If you know how to make use of it, you can turn the sudden death of a brother into the most wonderful thing in your life. You can really understand the importance of every day. The importance of your family and friends and loved ones. You grow so much from that. So don't kill yourself. You're wasting a wonderful opportunity to grow. After I've introduced the Buddhist teachings, I'm really happy that I've found the answer to life and simple Four Noble Truths. But 2 months, 3 months, 4 months have passed, I begin to feel miserable. Because people around me, they do not accept Buddhist teachings, e.g. my husband, my parents and my friends. What should I do or feel? It's just what husbands are like, just what friends are like. So just give them time. It's taken you a long time to find the Buddhist teaching, so don't be an evangelist. Don't go knocking on your husband's door to tell him the good news. Instead, be more sneaky. Especially a wife with her husband. Now, this story, this actually worked many times, worked really well. It was a Malaysian girl living in Perth, had an Australian husband. She came to my temple, was really getting into the meditation, the philosophy, making a really great impact, a very positive impact in her life. And obviously that she appreciated his teaching so much, she wanted to share it with the one man she really cared about, her husband, the person she really loved. But as soon as he mentioned religion to this guy, he said, no, no way am I going to go to any church or any temple, no way. I'll go to the pub, I'll go to the football, but not to the church or temple. I'm not interested. You can go, but don't give me any of that. And so she came to me and said, look, my husband won't even listen. What should I do? I said, very easy. Get a copy of my book. Any book would do, but, you know, my book, you know, because, you know, it's my book. And I said, take it home with you. And when you take it home, when you see your husband, tell your husband, keep your hands off of this. This is mine. That's all. Very simple. You know psychology. If you say that to your husband, keep your hands off this. This is mine. Of course he's going to get interested. And a couple of days later, she was out doing some shopping. He happened to be at home. What does he mean? This is mine. I can't look at this. What does he mean? So he picked it up and started reading it, and he didn't put it down till he was finished. And now he comes every week. It's a true story. This is actually how you'd be sneaky. Don't just do the direct approach. You should know how to get around your husband after all these years. So is understanding the way of life all that is required? Anything else? How about detachment? If you really understand the way of life, then you know what to be detached from and what to be attached to. Sometimes people, they get detached from the wrong things. Like one of my disciples who decided to keep the five precepts and give up drinking alcohol. Went to a party or was it some sort of function for his business. They gave him a glass of wine and he said, no, 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 I can't take that anymore, I'm a Buddhist. And the person said, are you a Buddhist? We know about Buddhists, it's all about letting go. Come and let go and have a... That's letting go of the wrong thing. So, there are some things to be attached to. For example, on SIA, Singapore Airlines, if you're going through turbulence, you're attached to that seatbelt. There's things to be attached to. There's sometimes to let go. Sometimes we have to know what to let go of, what to be attached to. So please be detached from things you can't change, from things which are totally out of your power to do anything about. Please be detached from the past. You can't do anything about that. Doesn't matter what happened to you, who died, what you did. Can't be changed. That's why we let go of the past. It's beyond our power. But please be attached to the present moment. This is where you do your work in life. That's where you put your energy. That's where the mind locks on to the present moment. And even the future. You know that if you start thinking about the future, you're not working in the present moment. And now is the time you make the future. So the more you stay in the present moment, the more you're constructing a beautiful, prosperous, healthy future for yourself. So you don't get healthy by thinking I'm going to go for a run tomorrow. You get healthy by going for a run now. Too many people, they plan, oh yeah, now I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that. And they never do it because they're always thinking about the future. In the present moment, now is where it happens. And so you attach to the present moment. Be attached to goodness, to kindness, compassion. And detach from anger or ill will or jealousy and fear. So the things to be attached to, you hold on to. Those things which are worth letting go of, you let them go. Things which you can't control. Why human beings keep on reading the Dharma, practice and continue chanting and still have numerous work problems? Is there any effective right way to be enlightened? Yes, because they eat the menus. They don't order the food. Even they might order the food, but they don't eat the food. So this is, it's always the case, these are beautiful teachings, but if they can actually practice them, Look, I guarantee if you could really say to yourself, with meaning, the door to my heart is open to me. Doesn't matter who I am or what I've done. And you do that with 100% sincerity. That is huge. So much of the misery and pain and difficulties in your life will vanish. If you make peace with yourself, it works. That's why people keep coming along and numbers actually grow there. But reading the Dhamma is just reading the menus. Even practicing it, maybe maybe ordering the food, but they're not really eating it. It's not really going inside. Sometimes it does take a time to get inside. But eventually it does. And after a while, oh, it's just beautiful. I am very spiritually inclined, but my parents are very worldly people. Living under the same roof, it is inevitable that we all have disagreements about the purpose of life, especially mine. The question is, do I keep quiet and nod my head out of respect and filial piety, or do I verbally disagree and state my point of view? Also, I'm very keen to lead a monastic life, but I'm afraid this will give my parents sorrow. I don't want to hurt them. I'm in a real dilemma, so I don't want to wait till I'm too old. Please advise. Okay, first of all, now with your parents, sometimes it's good to nod your head most of the time. And every now and again, if you think it's the right opportunity, just to get in there and say something. But with your parents, or like, you know, this is with your husband, or with your boss at work, or anyone else who's, you know, the power broker in that area, the way to get around them is not to have this verbal disagreement. You put your point of view again in the sneaky way. And say, no, it's very wonderful, like, you know, like being content or being kind. Ah, stupid, you should be working harder. Be quiet. Because what happens is when you've actually said something, it goes into the mind. It just needs time to gestate. I learned this when I was number 2 monk in my monastery in Australia. And I had to learn how to get my own way with my boss. This is how I did it. Classic story. I wanted to build a hut in a certain location. So I tell the abbot, why don't we build a hut on the hill over there? And he would say, it's a stupid idea, ridiculous. Now I was wise enough, I never argued. I know I've done enough by just putting that information into his brain. I would wait usually 2 weeks. 2 weeks is a good time because in 2 weeks I won't remember that conversation at all. And then I'd repeat it. I'd be walking with him close by. You know, why don't we build a hut on the hill over there? Stupid idea, ridiculous. No. Okay. Now the point is, it had to be done like subconsciously. If you argued, they'd remember that. And just because they're the boss, in principle, they would object. But when you did it this way, you're just putting that idea in. And it worked brilliantly every time. 2 weeks later, we'd be walking together, and he'd say, you know, I've just had an idea. Why don't we build a hut on the hill over there? And he would not remember where it came from. He would actually think it was his idea. And, you know, if you're, you know, sort of the number 2 in the family or in the you know, it's your parents, and you always say, what a wonderful idea of yours, Mum and Dad. That's why I said to this abbot, wow, what a great idea. Wow, you're such a wonderful idea of where this hut should go, abbot. I knew it came from me. Because when you put an idea in somebody's mind, they actually think about it without knowing it. It goes subconsciously through all those through the mind. And the important thing is, if it's a boss, it has to be their idea. At least that's what they assume. You know whose idea it was. As far as they're concerned, it's their idea. It doesn't matter. You get your own way. That's what you could do. And as for those parents, it is, seriously, it is bad karma to stop your children doing good things. And being a monk or a nun is a wonderful thing to do in life. Just, you know, see how much goodness I do in life. Serving, helping people, solving people's very deep problems. Imagine what had happened if my mum and dad had said, no, you can't be a monk. Fortunately, my father had no objections at all to me being a monk, because he died about 7 years earlier. And my mother said, as long as you're happy, then that makes me happy. But really, that's what parents should really be doing. They want their child to be happy. And the idea of being a monk or a nun gives you great inner happiness. And the amount you can serve the world is huge. Now, what they can do, what your child can do, if they become a monk or a nun and they're one of the good monks and nuns, is amazing. And anyway, most people that become monks and nuns, it's only for a short time. They don't make it. But it's a great experience for them for those years. And then they go back into the world again and get a job. They don't lose their career. They actually enhance their career. This is one person, one friend, they're applying for some top executive job. And they put on their CV, they were a meditator. Regularly. And they told me as soon as sort of the recruiting person, I forget it was the manager, you meditate? I said, yeah, how often? Oh, no, maybe an hour every day. They got the job on that, because they know if you meditate, you can handle stress. So they wanted somebody who wasn't going to stress out in this difficult job. So if you're a meditator, that's actually a great plus in your CV. And if you've been a monk for a few years, wow, we want to employ you. Can we keep going or is it time? Okay, so I'm terribly sorry about all these other ones, but karma being karma, maybe next time. So thank you again all for listening.
Thank you, Ajahn Brahm, for so patiently answering all the questions. We do want to make sure that Ajahn Brahm go back to the airport in time and not miss the flight. My apologies for having to cut short the question-answer session. Before we invite Ajahn to give us the end of the talk blessing, some announcements. Ajahn Brahm will be back again in Singapore on the 4th of March at 8 p.m. So those of you coming back for repeat classes, this is your opportunity. And Ajahn will be talking about making sense of what's happening in the world. Okay, and back in this place here, 8 p.m. Wednesday night. Now, if you want Ajahn Brahm for a longer period of time, here's your opportunity, executive retreat in Hua Hin, Thailand, from Saturday 13th of June to 21st of June. All right, if you choose to have a shorter retreat, a 5 days retreat, you're most welcome to join us as well. The cost is $680 for the 5 days retreat, $1,080 for 9 days retreat. There are more details in your flyer. I think you can see that in your chair. Another retreat is by Ajahn Katamalo. That's on Thursday, 30th of April to Sunday, 3rd of May at the Buddhist Fellowship. Buddhist Fellowship, those of you who are not members, we have a promotion. New members will get a copy of Ajahn Brahm's book, Happiness Through Meditation. So sign up. There's no limit to the number of years you can be members. More than 5 years, you're welcome. In fact, we have a life category membership, so many of us, in fact, are life members. So member for life.
Why don't we have like a 7-lifetime membership?
Right, we'll consider that. Coming up, Sunday talk, this Sunday is The Dharma of Dementia by Dr. Wong Win Fai. So, something to look forward to. And the following Sunday, 1st of March, by Brother Pia Tan, if you can't meditate, there's hope. Right, we'll be starting a group meditation over at the Buddhist Fellowship every Friday, starting from 30th of March. So those of you who are inclined to do meditation in group, this is your chance. Join us. You see the envelopes on your chair. All right, if you do want to make a donation, on your way out, you can drop in the donation box. And, of course, the newsletter, fresh off the printers. In fact, we just got it at 12 noon today. All right, there's also an Introduction to Buddhism class every Wednesday. The next session is about mental cultivation and development. Okay, that's all I have. So if we could end the session by inviting Ajahn Brahm to give us a blessing.
Okay, we do the blessing and then we do a sharing of merits. Do the blessing first of all.
Sabha Roga Vinimuto Sabha Santapa Vajito Sabha Veramati Gando Nibhuto Chatu Vagbhava Sabitiyo Viva Chantu Sabha Roga Vinasatu Mate Bhavan Vantarayo Sukhi Digayu Gopava Apiva Danhasilitsa Nichan Vutta Pachalino Chattaro Dhamma Vatanti Ayu Vano Sukhang Balan.
And now I'll just give the sharing of merits, the Idang Mei, we can join in.
Idam me nyatinam hotu sukhita hontu yatayo. Idam me nyatinam hotu sukhita hontu yatayo. Idam me nyatinam hotu sukhita hontu yatayo. Sadhu.
Sadhu. Very good. Okay. So have a good weekend, and I'll see you in a week or two's time. Take care.